You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Welcome everyone on Holy Friday, or as they say, Good Friday. Everyone's welcome, of course, no matter what your background, heritage, ability. We recognise that we're on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. We respect their elders, past and present. I'll light the chalice this morning. To begin with, I ask the question, what's the day about? Now, there's a traditional Christian answer which is very clear, and everyone here is familiar with that. But I want to draw something out of the story of Yeshua, the underlying principle, something that we can all relate to, is the principle of sacrifice. The fact that throughout history, so many people have gone to face pain, deprivation, even death, for what they believe in. People that have the courage of their convictions. And this is not some remote thing. It's relevant to our own lives, in our conversations with people, as we stand up for what's right in any given situation, as we go out of our way to care for people, often putting ourselves out to do so. These are small sacrifices, but in the story of Yeshua that we'll refer to today, it's the story of one of the most notorious sacrifices in human history, at least in the Western world. So today's dedicated to all of those who have had the courage of their convictions, particularly convictions of faith, not for us to judge them right or wrong, or to argue about their theology or how they expressed their faith. But how remarkable that so many through history have been so committed to their faith, to their God, as they understand it, that they're willing to be imprisoned, tortured, and killed. What soft lives we lead. How fortunate we are in 21st century Australia. We live in luxury. Perhaps the best time of history, I don't know. But we don't have to go far back into the past to see people who have faced terrible threats because of the faith they believe in. And indeed today in the world, there are many countries where people are facing persecution because of their faith, whether it be Muslims in India, Baha'i people in Iran, Christians in many countries of the world. So that's what I say today is about. So, a story for all ages. This is the story of Loilla, a young Narangeri woman, in fact a girl, because she has not yet reached womanhood. And she lives in the big camp at the side of the lake with her family and her family's family and her family's family's family. Her life was largely a joy, although she got told off occasionally. But because she was not yet of age, she was able to play with all the other girls and boys and was just occasionally given some adult duties, especially when the women went off to gather shellfish and vegetable roots and so on. Now, they lived in the main camp and there were lots of people there, but they had overnight camps, which were usually a day or half a day's walk. It was a long, tiring walk for Loilla, but she enjoyed the overnight camps. Usually just part of the family would go, sometimes just the women, But on this particular occasion that I'll tell you about, the men and the women were both heading down to another smaller lake where the women were going to gather some shellfish and dig for some vegetable roots. Along the way, she actually liked to mix in with the menfolk, and she was allowed to do that. The boys and girls mixed in between the two different groups, men and women, as they walked along. And as she was playing with some of the boys, they went past a wire fence, and her grandfather, who had told her this many times before, said once again, "Luella, don't you ever go the other side of that fence. That's where the white fella lives. Don't you ever go there, because there's no law over there." And she had heard the stories many times before of a couple of her uncles who had been killed by the white fella. The white fella wouldn't share their food, four-legged animals that they kept on the other side of the fence. And she had been told stories, although she didn't know any of these children, she'd been told stories of children who had gone over the fence and never been seen again. And she'd been told that their spirits were still there, unhappy forever. So she was very conscious of not going over the fence. Anyway, they got to the overnight camp, and the next morning she wasn't required to go and help digging out the shellfish. So she wandered along the shores of the smaller lake next to that camp. She'd wandered along for a long time, maybe for hours, when up ahead she saw, coming through the forest at the edge of the lake, a white fella with what she knew was a gun, a killing spear. And she froze. She hid behind a tree and she watched. And in the water, in the shallows, was a pelican. Bang! And the killing spear killed the pelican dead. The white fella walked onto the sandy part as if he was going to go towards the bird. Now, the pelican was very special. It was a terrible thing to kill a pelican. She was so overcome with rage at the injustice of it, she picked up a sizable rock, and even though she was only little, she threw it as hard as she could at the man, and she was a good shot. It hit him on the head. As soon as she'd thrown it, she'd hidden back behind the tree in the bush where she was. The white fella looked around. She could just see peeking through the thick bush next to the tree. He looked around, and perhaps he was worried about who had attacked him. Was it a group? So he thought better of doing anything else and fled back to his land on the other side of the fence. After waiting a good long while, Luella sized up the situation and she felt it was safe to go forward. She walked up to where the pelican had been shot. It was still alive. It was looking up at her and trying to say something with its big beak. It had been shot in the wing. It was almost as big as she was, but she picked it up. She knew she couldn't leave it there. She picked it up, and with all her strength, she marched back along the side of the lake to the overnight camp. And it took hours. And at times, she wanted to just let her arms go and let the bird drop on the ground. But it was warm. It was comforting to hold it. The blood had stopped oozing out of the wing, and the pelican looked content. There's no way she could just leave it there. So she walked on, staggered on towards the end, and got back to the camp. She showed the women the pelican and explained what had happened. When the menfolk came back from their hunting, the bird was taken to Luella's grandfather, and he said, "You can keep this bird. You now have a bond with it." And he explained to her how to make shellfish soup and feed that to the penguin to make it stronger. One of the men helped carry the pelican back to the main camp the next day, and it became what we would say her pet. She cared for it, she played with it. The pelican was happy to live in the main camp with the people. As time went on, Luella became very attached to the pelican. But she realised that the pelican could once again fly. It flew to the lake. She watched it. It would catch a fish and then come back again. Finally, the day came when something happened that nobody in the camp had ever seen before. A whole flock of pelicans, these special animals, came and landed in the middle of the main camp. The pelicans seemed to be chattering and flapping to each other. Her special pelican looked at her and then waddled and skipped over to join the flock. Luella knew what was going to happen. The flock took up and left. But she had such fond memories of that special bond she'd formed with the pelican that although she was sad to see it go, she was glad for their special time together. That's the end of the story. Now, as I say, I was going to focus today on sacrifice. But before I turn to the story of Yeshua, or Jesus, as people say, there are two examples I wanted to relay to you. You know, in World War I, for the soldiers killed, they said that the soldiers had made the supreme sacrifice, meaning that they had died for their country. But of course, we know that many of them went for adventure. They went because their mates went, peer pressure, and sometimes for the jingoism that said it would be, you know, a jolly good thing to go and give the Hun a blood nose, that sort of thing. They were there for all sorts of reasons. And many of them, once there, even if they wanted to leave, there was no easy way home. So that was a sacrifice of sorts, but I'm talking today about people who consciously put their lives in danger for their faith. So the one example that I wanted to give today was Michael Servetus. He was born in Spain, Miguel Servito, and he was encouraged towards a religious career from an early age. By the time he turned 20, he was involved with the church and in fact took part in a very, very minor role at the imperial coronation of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. This is in the 1500s. And soon after that, however, Servetus, to take his Latin name, was studying the Bible and coming to his own conclusions. It was a time of Protestant rethinking of the Bible and the whole Christian structure of theology. So he wrote his book, The Errors of the Trinity, and that, of course, was anathema, heresy, to the Roman Catholic Church. He had to move and moved around in the area of Strasbourg, Lyon, Geneva, and once there was a crackdown on heretics in that area, he finally went to Paris, changed his name for a while to Michel Villeneuve, but he continued preaching and writing heretically. Eventually, the officers of the Inquisition of the church began to catch up with him, and so he had to flee Paris. He decided that the safest place for him was actually to go back to Italy. He travelled through Switzerland. Now, whether this was courage or folly, but he decided, because he'd been corresponding with John Calvin, the famous Protestant leader, and a very strict interpretation of Christianity of his own that Calvin had, Calvin had told Servetus that he was a heretic and that he was in error, because the way Servetus had set it out, the word logos, which is generally translated in English as the word, Servetus said the word was the expression of God. The spirit was something within the human being. And Jesus was a manifestation of the word. But that doesn't mean that Jesus was a God, just the Son of the eternal God. Now, this was enough to not only upset the Catholics, but upset the Protestants as well. So poor old Servetus was on the run, but he thought, I'm travelling through Switzerland. What an opportunity. This man, this brilliant theologian with whom I've disagreed, but John Calvin is preaching in Geneva next Sunday. What an opportunity. I'll go along to his sermon. So he did, sitting in the back row, probably wearing a scarf or something like that. But he had achieved sufficient notoriety that no doubt images of him had been circulated, and someone in the congregation, I don't know if it was John Calvin himself, said, "That man looks like Michael Servetus." And they grabbed him, and that was the end of it. Within months, he was burnt with his books underneath him, and he came to an end. There was an example of someone who could have taken the easy option, the quiet life. And all of us, have those forks in the road. You can live the quiet life. You can just go with the flow, avoid conflict, take the easy way out every time. But it's not always the right thing to do. And Servetus had the courage of his convictions. The other example that I want to give is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian. He was born 1906 into a reasonably wealthy and well-educated family. His inclination was toward the church and theology from an early time. He took his master's degree and then a doctorate by the time he was 24. But he was too young to be ordained, so he went to do some postdoctoral study in New York. Now, I don't know if it was a Unitarian seminary, but he wrote home, "Hier gibt es kein Theologie. Here there is no theology." Which was, anyway, that was his view of the seminary where he was learning, and perhaps wasn't as strict or conservative as what he had been studying in Berlin. So at the end of that short period of study, he returned back to Berlin and was ordained at the age of 25 as a minister in the Protestant Church of Germany at the time. His ministry soon ran into trouble because within a couple of years, the Nazis came to power. Hitler became chancellor at the beginning of 1933, and things became problematic from there. Just 2 days after the Nazis fully came to power, Bonhoeffer was giving a radio address on leadership, and he spoke vehemently against the principle that a human being, a national leader, should be called der Führer, the leader. For him, there was only one leader, and that was Jesus Christ. So before he even finished the radio address, it was cut off. And his name, no doubt, went into the files. He continued that year with his ministry, but it was a time that the Nazis were implementing a policy which they called Gleichschaltung, meaning that everything should flow in the one direction, like an electric current. Meaning that every organisation, large and small, social, political, industrial, whatever, should become Nazified and somehow under the control of the Nazi state. This applied to the Protestant Church as well. So, unconstitutionally, Hitler said there will be fresh elections, and there were a whole number of German church, inverted commas, candidates who were there to take over the Protestant church. Despite Bonhoeffer's campaigning efforts, they won. And most of the churches, dioceses, parishes around Germany became under the influence of these Nazi-sponsored candidates. They were Christians, but they were comfortable with Nazism. There's a contradiction there, but I won't go into it right now. Bonhoeffer, in a sense, went underground and began teaching in underground seminaries. Fortunately, there were still many good Christians who rejected the Nazi rule, and so he had a lot of places he could move around to and continue training ministers Now, one of the great things about his time in the US was that he found very appealing the spirituality in the Afro-American Christian churches. He found that Christ was preached with such passion and vigor, it was exciting, rather than listening to the long, dry intellectual sermons, which were probably more common in his homeland at the time. And he also, through mixing with many of the Afro-American parishioners, came to see that there was a great compelling need for Christians to fight social injustice. And he was staggered by the fact that even the church in New York wasn't part of the movement to smooth out social differences and desegregate. The fact that there were essentially white churches and Afro-American churches. So when he got back to Germany, he was conscious with every bit of his preaching that the people who were being persecuted needed to be helped. The poor, even the communists, and the Jews. In fact, Bonhoeffer did a lot in his writings and his support for the Jewish people who were being persecuted in the 30s in Germany. Gradually, the Nazi regime cracked down even on these underground seminaries. In 1936, Bonhoeffer had the opportunity to go to London when things were getting hot, so to speak. He spent a couple of years there, and it broadened his perspective. But, of course, he had friends, Christians, still in Germany who said, look, the fight needs to be taken on here. We need your help here. You're such a great intellectual. We need you here, not helping from outside. So he stayed a couple of years. He was even offered the opportunity to go and study with Gandhi, nonviolent resistance. But that was getting to the point where he thought, no, I'm getting further away from the people that I really belong to. And he went back to Germany in 1938. Things got worse and worse in terms of people being arrested, pastors, parishioners, friends of Bonhoeffer's. And in June 1939, he didn't know that this was just two or three months before the war, he took a trip upon invitation to America to return there. But as soon as he got there, he felt the pangs of remorse, felt that he needed to be with his own people where he could contribute something to their salvation through the darkest of times, if war in fact was to come. So he returned almost immediately. The war started September 1939, and he continued with his underground Christian ministry. In 1943, they finally caught up with him. He was arrested, spent more or less 2 years in concentration camps and so on. And then finally, tragically, within a month of the end of World War II, he and a whole lot of other prisoners were hanged, executed. The remarkable thing about Bonhoeffer's story is that his conviction, which was not only intellectual but working actively to help those who were being persecuted, was something that he pursued despite knowing the extreme danger to himself and his friends. So that act of courage to return to Germany when he could have happily sat out the war in London or New York, I think is extraordinary. And I come back to the point that each of us in our lives has those opportunities to be courageous, to go one step further, to help people, to care for people, whatever form that might take. Now, I come back to the Christian story. It was common for many people to come into Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, at the time of Pesach, the Passover. Now, the Passover is a festival which essentially celebrated the exodus of Jewish people from Egypt. After that escape, Moses had undergone a massive ritual with his people whereby a blood covenant was expressed. This was a ritual where an animal was slaughtered, blood was sprayed up towards the altar, toward God, and down toward the people. The concept of a blood covenant is something that occurs in many societies around the world at that time and before and since. There was a book written in the 1880s by a fellow called Clay Trumbull about the blood covenant, and he exhaustively goes through anthropological case studies of where Russia, Africa, all parts of Asia and so on, that people had sealed a deal with God or the gods with the spilling of blood. From time immemorial, people have realized that blood is a liquid, a substance of power, because of course primitive people knew that if blood was shed, then life could be lost. So it was equated with life itself. To seal an agreement, a pact, a covenant with blood was to make it as sacred and binding as it could possibly be. Now, looking at it from our society in our times, one can look at the covenant that Moses was expressing, and we may have a question. Because Yahweh, the God at that time of the Jewish people, was a particular God who looked after those people. And I think the understanding of most of us today is that to the extent we appreciate God, the extent we have any sense of God, God is not particular. God is not like the captain of a football team that is there for those people who identify and wear those colours. God is God. And although we might give many names and descriptions, and there might be many ways to approach God through devotion, study, and service, God is equally available to every human being, if there's a God at all. So we look back at that covenant, and we can see that it was with a particular people at a particular time. So then we have Yeshua recorded as talking about covenant when he comes in to have the final meal with his disciples before what we now call Good Friday. In fact, if we work through the timeline, because we've just begun the festival of Pesach this year, it depends on the moon, and it's always around this particular month in the Jewish calendar. And it's an eight-day festival, and there are procedures to be followed at different times through that festival. So Jesus arrived the day before the lambs were slaughtered for the sacrifice. Josephus, the Roman historian, estimated that 250,000 lambs were slaughtered in Jerusalem at that time, which must have been just about every Jewish household. And a small proportion of those were at the Great Temple. So if you really work back through the chronology and take the book attributed to Mark as the earliest biography and sequence of these events, then Yeshua would have arrived on the Wednesday and been killed on the Thursday. What happened later in terms of Christian church formulation of the calendar and Good Friday and Easter Monday, I won't go into that story. But the point is that Yeshua knew what he was facing. He didn't have to go into Jerusalem. He knew that the authorities were out to get him because his preaching offended the established church and the Romans. He was an unsettling preacher. But he resolved to go into Jerusalem, and he is reported to have said these curious words at the last meal. Not unusual for them to eat together, not unusual for them to share bread and wine together, but as described, it became a special ritual. Now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I'll always maintain that the words of Yeshua as recorded can't be taken literally. If I look at the Gospel of Thomas, which I place great store in. One of the sayings of Jesus or Yeshua recorded there is that the person who drinks from my mouth will not be thirsty. Now, I haven't heard anyone suggest that people are actually going to use the mouth of the person as a drinking bowl or something like that. It's clearly metaphorical, and it echoes the story of the woman at the well. You know, drink from my water and you won't be thirsty again. So I think one can expect something other than a straightforward meaning when it comes to the words said to be used by Yeshua at this final supper. Knowing that he was pretty well courting death by coming into Jerusalem at all. So I'll ask us now to, those who wish to take part in this ritual meal together. Reading from the book attributed to Mark, chapter 14. And when they were eating, after taking a loaf of bread and blessing God, he broke it and distributed to them, saying, "Take it. This is my body." So I'll ask you to take a piece of bread, but we'll just hold on to that for a moment, and then we'll all eat together. And taking a cup and giving thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant being shed on behalf of many." Now, I'll invite you to come forward, apart from a couple that I can help. There is wine on one side and grape juice on the other. So, still holding your bread, I'll invite you to come forward and take a glass if you wish. So once we collect ourselves, let us recall in this moment the extraordinary sacrifices that people have made, especially for those who have been so committed to their faith, to their understanding of God, that they are prepared to lay down their life for that conviction. Let us eat and drink together. Now, I'll ask you, if you will, to repeat after me the words of this prayer. You may take it as a prayer, you may take it as words of affirmation. If you are the least bit uncomfortable, you need not take part at all. If it helps your contemplation, you may wish to close your eyes. So I will repeat each line, I'll say it twice, and then invite you to repeat it. We make room in our lives for what is holy and good. We make room in our lives for what is holy and good. We make room in our lives for what is holy and good. We nurture the presence of holiness in our lives. We nurture the presence of holiness in our lives. We nurture the presence of holiness in our lives. And we draw guidance from it. And we draw guidance from it. And we draw guidance from it. We let go of the need to have our own way all the time. We let go of the need to have our own way all the time. We let go of the need to have our own way all the time. We are prepared to be guided by the Spirit of life. We are prepared to be guided by the Spirit of life. We are prepared to be guided by the Spirit of life. We are grateful for the signs and guidance in our life. We are grateful for the signs and guidance in our life. We are grateful for the signs and guidance in our life. Guidance which encourages us to be kind and gracious. Guidance which encourages us to be kind and gracious. Guidance which encourages us to be kind and gracious. We forgive ourselves for when we have hurt others. We forgive ourselves for when we have hurt others. We forgive ourselves for when we have hurt others. We let go of all anger and resentment toward others who have hurt us. We let go of all anger and resentment toward others who have hurt us. We let go of all anger and resentment toward others who have hurt us. We pray for strength and courage for the challenges ahead of us. We pray for strength and courage for the challenges ahead of us. We pray for strength and courage for the challenges ahead of us. We pray for peace. We pray for peace. We pray for peace. May it be so. May it be so. May it be so. We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.